As Chris may have told you, we're going to be tape recording this conversation. And what I wanted to do is just start off by introducing everyone. My name is Al Prego. I work for the FCIC.
Jay Lerner, also with the FCIC.
Sarah Knaus, also with the FCIC.
Mark Hingston, with OTS.
Okay, as you may have been told, the FCIC was established in May of 2009 to examine the causes of the financial crisis, and one of the 22 areas that are covered by statute is for us to examine the role of the regulator in the various institutions that either failed or would have failed had they not received exceptional government assistance. And I'm sure you're already aware that we've spoken to numerous OTS officials and asked them, you know, similar questions that we're about to go into today. So can you please summarize your educational background and then highlight your various roles and responsibilities while at OTS, including your time at CIO and the events leading of AIG's transfer to your supervision?
Sure. Again, good morning, everyone. My name is Michael Fitt. I'm currently regional director for the OTS Northeast region. I graduated from Susquehanna University with an undergraduate degree in 1986, after which I started my career with the Federal Home Loan Bank of New York in December of 1986. My degree from Susquehanna was in economics and human resource management, and I do not have a secondary degree beyond that. Starting in 1986 at the Federal Home Loan Bank, I was a financial analyst coming out of college and continued in that role for 2 to 3 years at the beginning. From that point, I transferred to an examiner position where I worked out in the field examining financial institutions, where I did that role for several years, probably about 3 or 4 years. At which point I began to specialize in capital markets issues as a capital markets examiner and probably continued in that role for about 5 years. So about midway through my career, I took an opportunity to become the executive assistant for the regional director here in the Northeast OTS Northeast region. I should mention as well, I was with the Federal Home Loan Bank of New York, which was converted into a federal agency in 89. So I never had a separation of employment. It just continued through. But somewhere around the time of 90, probably 90, 98, 99, again, I took a role to come and work for the regional director in the Jersey City office here to coordinate all of our policy work in providing guidance to exam staff and information on issues that were arising in the region. So again, I work closely as part of the senior management team here to get guidance out to our regional staff and then also to provide input to our Washington office on larger policy issues. I continued in that role for about 2 years until I became financial analysis manager, where I headed up a unit in the Northeast region that looked at economic and market trends across the region and across the industry and provided information to our case managers so that they could be better informed on issues that were affecting the industry. Somewhere around early 2002, I think it was February, I was invited to come take a position in our Washington office, which was the acronym was OSSR. It was the Office of Supervisory Standards and Review. Essentially, what they wanted me to do was to come to Washington to do a lot of the work that I had done here in the Northeast region to develop a national financial monitoring and surveillance unit that would look across all of the regions and provide information out to the regions, as well to evaluate the way in which regions were approaching the assessment of higher risk activities and to be able to provide guidance to the staff on best practices in terms of how we did that. I continued in that role for about 2 years till January of 2004, when I was made the head of a new unit, which was called the Complex and International Organizations Unit, or CIO, as it's known. CIO was developed because of emerging issues in terms of international coordination of supervisory activities, partly due to what was coming out of the European Union with the Financial Conglomerates Directive. And the OTS, up till that point, had not had an expansive program in terms of handbook guidance and programs for the exam staff for how to deal with the changing international coordination and roles. So, again, one of my main responsibilities was to develop and flesh out that program so that we could provide guidance to the staff on handling institutions that had international activities. Again, that was in August of 2004. That same year, the regional director for the OTS West region had retired and come the summertime. It was around the July time frame. I was asked to serve as regional director for the OTS West region. So I moved to San Francisco from Washington in the fall of 2004 and served as regional director for the OTS West region for 3 years, at which point the regional director for the Northeast region had retired in the summer of 2007, and I was asked to come back and serve as regional director for the OTS Northeast region, which I presently serve as. So from the period of September of 2007 to the present, there was a change in the way that AIG was supervised, which had been supervised by the CIO unit in Washington. That supervision was transferred to the Northeast region, or responsibility for that oversight was transferred to the Northeast region in July of 2008, like July 6th, 7th, 8th, somewhere thereabout. So right, I guess, in the summer of the crisis, the responsibility for AIG was given to the Northeast region, at which point I began to become involved in understanding the work that was being done on AIG.
Thank you, Mr. Finn. Hey, let me ask you this. When we spoke to the former managing director of CIO, he said that one of the very first decisions undertaking was that of centralizing the supervision of AIG within the Washington office of the OTS, which, of course, as you alluded, which was previously at the region. Having explained the safety and soundness rationale for doing that, do you know about the decision-making and rationale for then decentralizing supervision back to the region in July of 2008 during a period of significant stress at AIG? And just wanted to know what you knew about the rationale for that.
What I know is that there were one or two senior managers meetings, what we call RMG meetings, where there was discussion with the Washington senior management about how best to move forward with the CIO program. I think the individual you may have spoken to was C.K. Lee, who had headed up that unit for roughly 3 years, I guess. He had been asked to serve as regional director for the Midwest region, I think it was in May of 2008. So the CIO unit was going to go through a transition period, and I think the number two in that unit, Brad Waring, roughly around the same time had accepted an assistant director position in the OTS Southeast region. So the thought process was, with the two senior leaders of that unit moving on, how best could we bring forward that work? I can't speak for the decision makers, but my understanding is that they felt that there was expertise that was mostly in the region that had been working on the case in terms of the examination staff, and that also my experience from the Washington days where I was very actively involved in international dialogue on a number of institutions, and also a representative on a subcommittee of the Basel Committee, that there was some synergy to having that come to the Northeast region, because we had two of the firms, two of the three firms that were subject to CIO supervision in AIG and General Electric. The third firm, Ameriprise, was supervised out of our Midwest region, which would have been under the purview of CK League. So again, between CK and myself, we would have had the background and experience in international supervision to be able to oversee that. What was agreed was a hybrid approach, though. The program itself, the for updating handbooks and such, which generally you would want to see centralized, was retained in the Washington office, I think, under Donna Deal and Barbetta Gardiner, so that we could develop consistent policies and practices that would be used throughout the program. But the oversight and the supervision, again, that responsibility was put out to the region.
Okay. I guess you had said that you were briefly involved in CIO before being assigned as a Northeast Regional Director. And I guess...
West Region Director.
I'm sorry, yes. When you were preparing for the transition for the OTS to become more involved in the Financial Conglomerates Directive, do you recall enacting and rolling out formal examiner training? Now, I'm not just talking about maybe updating policies, procedures, or a handbook, but conducting formal examiner training to instruct folks that are going into these Category 3 complex enterprises as to how to identify and detect risk across the enterprise?
I do recall being involved in work that was developing what would have been what ultimately became Holden Company's handbook section 940. There were various expectations that international supervisors had accepted as best practice with regard to assessing capital, intra-group transactions, and risk concentrations. And I did work when I was in Washington with subgroups that developed at least initial procedures in each of those elements, and was playing a part in the early development of that section 940. I think ultimately the handbook release and the subsequent training that would have occurred was after my tenure there, because again, my involvement was roughly 7 months at the early stages of just developing that.
Do you have any knowledge as to when formal examiner training would have been rolled out, whether that had been in 2006 or 2007, just a ballpark, or would you like to get back to us on that?
I don't know. Again, I was in the West region when that program was, when ultimately the supervision where the exam responsibilities were pulled to the Washington office, and also when those procedures were formally rolled out. So I don't have knowledge of exactly when training would have occurred.
Okay. Okay, the April 2007 target exam of AIGFP noted an increase in super senior CDS portfolio that was protecting CDOs backed by subprime mortgages. And I've reviewed a number of the credit committee presentations, and not only was it subprime assets, but it was also a lot of Alt-A as well. The target exam stated that they were going to be looking at subprime CDO issue during the 2008 target. And my question is, do you know why the OTS pushed the review into 2008 and not simply expand the scope in April of 07 when you guys were identifying that exposure?
I don't know how the decision was made in April of 2007 to finalize that work and issue their interim rating downgrade. I was not part of that dialogue in terms of deciding at that point to issue the interim downgrade.
I'm sorry.
And again, I don't have knowledge as to how they decided at that time to plan out the work for the remainder of the year. I am aware that when I became involved in July, that the examiners were planning to do work in evaluating the subprime and Alta ACDOs. But again, I don't have knowledge of the decision-making at the April time frame.
You mentioned the interim rating downgrade. That wasn't until March of 2008.
Correct. Okay. Which was ultimately the culmination of the 2007, the work that had been done throughout 2007.
Well, because the holding company regular report that I have from 2007, which is done in June of 2007, has a rating of 2, or fundamentally sound, for the enterprise. So, and the OTS officials we've talked to stated that the interim rating downgrade that occurred in March of 2008 was precipitated by the material weakness determination by PwC and the 8K filing February 11, 2008. So I'm trying to understand if that's a wrong sequence of events. You know, just please clarify the record for me.
I don't think it's a wrong sequence of events. I think in the 2000, well, I can't speak directly to knowledge that I have of how the two rating in 2007 was developed or issued. What I generally know, though, is that when we issue an examination, typically that work is the culmination of roughly a year's worth of work that has been done. So in the 2007 exam, it would have been evaluating conditions that existed at the organization and its earnings, its capital position, over the course of the prior year. So it actually would extend back into 2006. You're right, I think, in that ultimately the downgrade that occurred in March of 2008 was largely driven by the material weaknesses that were identified through the audit firm and the subsequent filing that came out from the company, in addition to work that we had been doing after the 2007 examination. We continued, and we used the process of continuous supervision. So even though we issued that 2007 exam, our work did not stop for 1 year forward. We continued to make our own assessments. And I believe, and again, you'll have to accept that I'm going from memory here from what I've been informed, that we were doing work in late 2007 that was raising concerns in addition to what came out of the material, the significant material deficiency finding. So our work, in addition to that material deficiency, resulted in that March of 2008 downgrade. I don't think the downgrade happened exclusively or solely because of the material deficiency.
Okay, fair enough. You just have to realize I understand the OTS continuous supervisory framework because it's similar to what the OCC does. And that you do frequent target reviews and there's constant work going on. I was just simply commenting on from the 27 reports of exam and visitations that I looked at, that was just the sequence of events that I tried to piece together based on the written exam reports that we saw. So, okay. I think you touched on this a little earlier in your answer. When we spoke with Mr. Waring, he wasn't aware as to why the special target for the subprime CDS book, why that never took place in 2008. I guess you were given supervision of it in July of 2008, and I know that you may not be aware of events that happened before you officially took over responsibility, but do you know why? What factors were at play as to why there was never any follow-up in 08 on this pretty material risk area that was commented on in the April 07 target of FP?
I do not know why the decision was made to defer, and I honestly was not aware in the early stage of 2008 that that work had been planned. So I can't speak directly to that decision.
Okay. Thank you very much for providing the documents. Chris, Mr. Sturbins helped us try to get some email documentation loaded, and we were just reviewing that. And I'm sorry I can't show this to you because you're not here, but essentially I'll just summarize. It's just an email from you, and this was in the June 2004 time frame. And it's basically, I'll just summarize, it's basically saying that that you have an estimate that's going to be $300,000 that AIG is going to be paying for its annual assessment for the OTS, and that you had a concern that our actual examination expenses might significantly exceed that $300,000 assessment, and that in the email, you were saying that there might have to be a special assessment to AIG or to any other enterprise to make up the shortfall. Is that pretty much the way it works?
Yeah, I don't recall this exact time frame in which we modified our holding company assessment process, but around that time frame, when we created the categorizations, we issued a rule on assessment expenses that indicated Category 1 holding companies would be charged a flat base fee for holding company supervision that was based on the estimate of how much time it would take to do the regular monitoring of those holding companies and examinations. Category 2s would be charged an elevated fee based on a combination of their category, their asset size, and their rating, so that we would be able to be reimbursed or receive assessment income that would be greater for the more complex or higher-risk holding companies. In addition, again, we rolled out a Category 3 determination that would be for generally those firms that were internationally active and would require even a broader level of supervisory oversight. And I believe that the initial assessment for a Category 3 holding company was three times what would be charged for Category 2. So I accept what is said in that email as being accurate. I don't recall specifically the numbers that you're referencing, but we would have made an analysis to see whether or not the amount that would be derived from our regulation for Category 3 companies, we would evaluate that relative to the actual work that we need to do. And if it exceeds that Category 3 collection, then we would make a special assessment.
So can you address to what extent then assessments revenue, if you will, drove any examination scope or any examination duration of any of the enterprises, and particularly AIG? Is that a consideration?
What I would say is that we would plan the work that we believed was appropriate to do and conduct that work and then evaluate how many hours were put into that effort and compare what we needed to do relative to what we collected, and then we would collect whatever was appropriate based on the work we did. So we did not cut back on our work to match the dollars that would have come out of the base assessment. We prepared and conducted the work we needed to do and then would backbill for anything that was above the baseline assessment.
And the reason I mentioned that is because and this would have preceded your role in the supervision of AIG, we're talking about 2007, is because we've heard that the decision to not expand the scope was because of resource constraints. And resource constraints could be many things. It could be, you know, we don't have enough examination manpower to undertake a prolonged a drill down of this portfolio or X portfolio, or, you know, it could be, you know, I'm curious if it was anything driven off of assessments. That's the nature of the question.
Right. You know, the comments that were made about the available resources prior to my time, I can't really speculate on what they would have been referring to. I just don't have any direct knowledge.
Okay, Mr. Finn, that's fair. So you started then your role and responsibility as being head of supervision, if you will, of AIG in July of 2008, when there was already significant stress at the company. And I guess from discussion with Mr. Lee, we were told that around March 31st, his role kind of like went away because he was transferred to, I believe, Dallas as the regional director in Dallas. And so between the April and May and June time frame, it would have still been CIO in Washington under Mrs. Luke, or if that's correct?
Again, I don't know. I don't have the specific transfers of responsibilities. My recollection is that C.K. Lee transferred to the Western region in May of 2007. So
2008
transition. I'm sorry. Excuse me. 2008.
Okay.
2000. Yes. 2008. May of 2008. So my recollection of the timing was that there was a time where the program was under an acting leader, but that it was a smaller duration of roughly a month and a half, not 3 or 4 months. Again, I'm just going from my recollection. I don't have the knowledge of exactly when C.K. Lee moved, but my recollection was May of 2008. There were discussions as to how to manage that program after his departure, and ultimately the decision was made in early July to bring it to the Northeast region.
Okay. So can you walk us through, it's July of 2008, and there's significant stress going on in the financial sector and significant rate of rising delinquencies on subprime and prime and Alt-A, and you're being asked to be the lead on AIG. Can you walk us through that sequence of events? What led up to that, and what was being done?
Sure. The one of the first decisions that we needed to make in the region was the management hierarchy that would be put into place on supervision for the case. There are several levels in our management hierarchy that would be involved in supervision. That was one decision that we needed to make. The other thing was to meet with and get views from the team on the issue, the exam team that is, on the issues that they were seeing and the work that they were planning. And the third element would have been to make some introduction to the firm so that the transition had reasonable contact and build a rapport with the firm that we were taking on responsibility for. So within the Northeast region, there are numerous levels that would be applied in the supervision of a firm. The EIC for the company was Thomas O'Rourke, and he had a team of people that would be working with him, and we chose or did not choose to make any change in that team, so the team continued to have responsibility for the day-to-day examination work that would have been conducted. The supervision of the case at the, moving up the organizational chart would have reported to Marty Lavelle, who was an assistant director on the case. Marty, along with field manager Joe Keough, had operating and supervisory responsibility for the FSB of AIG, which was roughly a $1 billion organization. So, again, we thought that bringing that exam team under that hierarchy would give us the synergy of knowledge with the firm. As well, Marty Lavelle and Joe Keough were actively involved in the supervision of AIG prior to its transfer to CIO. So, again, there was some history of knowledge there. Above Marty Lavelle would have been Regional Deputy Director Mike Simone, who would have overseen the supervision and practices of our examiners across the region. And then Mike Simone reported to me, who, again, Mike Simone would have responsibility for reporting out to me significant issues coming out of examinations and whether or not we need to take actions and such. So, again, that was the hierarchy that we determined to operate with. We did at the early outset, probably within the first few weeks of taking on responsibility, have a discussion with the exam team about the views that had come out. Much of what was shared was the information that had been produced in late 2007, early 2008, that led to the ratings downgrade. So we were brought up to speed on what was being done there, and also brought up to speed on the current work that was being done, which was largely assessing the activities that AIG was conducting to develop a remediation plan that was required in response to the March of 2008 activities. We attempted to set up a meeting, I think it was for late July, with the AIG regulatory team, the team that worked with communicating with our team. I think that meeting ultimately did not come off until perhaps the first or second week of August. I don't remember the exact dates. But we did go across, Mike Simone, myself, the EIC for the company, went across and met with the regulatory team to, again, introduce them to the new OTS leadership, and as well get their input on issues that the firm was working on at that point in time. So that introduction was made in, again, I believe it was early August. Throughout the period, then we would have normal processes with the examiners as they would conclude work on a targeted review. As you had mentioned, they did series of targeted reviews. As that work would have been concluded, that would have been run up through the hierarchy of command, and again, issues that were identified that we're developing, we would make a determination on how best to address that.
Do you recall if during the time that you took over, if there was ever any examination work being done at FP in Connecticut or FP in London?
I recall that there were plans to do work at FP in London. I don't have a specific recollection of work at that point that was planned in Connecticut. It certainly could have been planned, and it may have been going, but I don't recall specifically Connecticut. I think ultimately the team had set up a scope document to conduct a review of FP's London operation, and I do recall seeing the scope of that review and believing that it was appropriate work to be conducted. The planning for that meeting, I think, was to target a review, an on-site review visit to London in the mid-September timeframe. And as it worked out, I think that review was actually in progress the week that AIG went through its rescue from the Federal Reserve. And in addition, we have been trying to coordinate a meeting where I would have had the ability to meet with the French supervisors and the European and the UK supervisors during that visit, but I was asked to go to a different meeting by our senior leadership in Washington that caused me to not go on that trip. So I ended up being not being with the group during that work, but they did go forward with that targeted review in London.
Yes, we did see that. I think that I recall that was the last target review of FP. And I think it started September the 2nd, and as you mentioned, it went through the emergency loan that was granted on September the 16th. So I guess it's correct to say then that at the time that you became in charge, there were plans being made to execute an examination, but there wasn't really any examiners on the ground at FP, correct?
Again, I'm going based on my recollection. We may have had staff that was at FP in Connecticut. On international trips, we do have an approval process to authorize international travel, and the only international travel that I can recall from that time frame was the trip to London during that early September venue. Whether examiners visited Wilton, Connecticut during the 2 months that I was involved, I don't have specific recollection as to whether or not they were there. I do know that we did have our team in New York. Whether or not they made any individual trips to Connecticut, I'm just not aware of.
Okay, earlier, Mr. Finn, you mentioned the remediation plan. And yes, it was our understanding that when AIG was downgraded to a 3 on March 7, 2008, OTS gave AIG 30 days to submit a remediation plan to correct the risk management and oversight deficiencies that culminated in the material weakness determination by PwC. Now, the OTS records that we have seen indicated that AIG submitted the remediation plan on July 28, 2008, and that OTS reviewed and accepted the plan on August 28, 2008, roughly 2 weeks before AIG's collapse. So can you comment, or if you know, as to why AIG took so long to submit a remediation plan?
You're indicating that the remediation plan was due within 30 days from the date of the supervisory letter.
Right. That's our understanding, is at the time that OTS downgraded and issued the 3, and CK Lee sent that letter to the board, it's our understanding from talking to OTS officials that one of the supervisory actions, if you will, that was taken in addition to the downgrade was you got 30 days to submit a remediation plan as to how you're going to fix the oversight and the risk management weaknesses. And so, I mean, that would put in April, somewhere April 2008 time frame, and then I guess from what we've seen is they finally submitted a plan on July the 28th, and OTS reviewed it and accepted on the 28th of August. So we were just wondering why AIG took so long to submit a plan, if you know.
I don't. I think CK Lee would have had responsibility during that time when that 30-day period expired. I don't know whether or not there was correspondence that exchanged that offered an extension of time, and I don't know what discussion would have occurred or did occur that would have, where OTS would have offered an extension of time. I'm not aware of what transpired during that 30-day period or beyond that.
Would it be possible, Chris, to get any documentation? Maybe you have already provided it to us in the production that was given last week, I think. But any documentation that said, hey, maybe there is documentation that says that AIG did submit a plan, but OTS didn't think it was comprehensive and they gave it back and it was a back and forth thing. Perhaps that was the case. But the reason I pulled the July 28th is just right off of the documents.
We'll see what we can find.
Okay, thanks. Okay, Mr. Finn, and again, this letter, I mean, this decision precedes you in your official role, but nonetheless, we wanted to get your view on this. As late as February 1st, 2008, AIG still retained a savings and loan holding company rating of a 2. And basically, that means that the enterprise is fundamentally sound with some modest weaknesses that could be corrected in the normal course of business. Under the circumstances at the time, do you, in your opinion, feel that the 2 was appropriate in February 08?
I find it very difficult to render a view on a rating of a company that I don't have knowledge of the conditions that existed at that point in time. The developing ratings is a very, I think, elaborate process of weighing many, many factors, understanding the management team and how they approach their risk management, truly understanding the capital position and whether or not it is sufficient relative to overall risk, and also understanding the various different components, including feedback that we would get from insurance supervisors regarding many of the insurance subsidiaries. Again, without knowledge of what those views would have been at that point in time, I really don't feel like I could offer a view on the appropriateness of the rating.
Okay, fair enough. When it was transferred to you in July of 2008, and you were brought up to speed on the condition of AIG, and of course probably had a chance to review the filings, the first quarter numbers that came in May of 2008, what did you think of the current rating of 3? Was there any discussion at the time that it was transferred to you to do an interim rating downgrade to a 4, since the condition of AIG was rapidly deteriorating?
I did not have any immediate discussions of conducting a ratings downgrade when I took on the supervision. I would not be the one that derives that rating. Again, it comes out of the exam process. What I do recall is that at the time where I was being first briefed on the AIG situation, there were actually some events that were quite positive. The firm, I think, if memory is correct here, was able to conduct a capital raise that brought in over $20 billion. I think it was in the month of May of 2008.
Yes.
So there were actually, while the market conditions broadly were deteriorating, the firm, AIG, was actually able to go to the markets with a very successful offering in terms of strengthening the equity capital position and providing greater buffers for risk. So I think while we certainly had concerns that were appropriate around AIG's risk management, some of the financial weaknesses that there were concerns about with regard to the valuation of some of their relationships would have been mitigated by that capital raise. So again, at the point in which I took over, there were countervailing factors, or there were some mitigating factors that were occurring as well. And again, I would not, for firms I supervise, determine a rating on my own from a high-level view without the knowledge of what was coming up from the field examination. And there was no discussion from the field or the management team responsible for the day-to-day supervision of rating of a ratings downgrade at that point in time.
Do you know when you first became aware that there were cash collateral calls on the CDS book, that the value of the CDO underlying protection fell in value? And, I mean, I asked this just you personally, when you first became aware of that, or if you know when first OTS became aware of that.
I don't know when OTS first became aware of that. I do recall a period, probably in the August time frame, where our staff was aware that collateral calls were coming in. And I believe it was an email from the EIC discussing the increased collateral position that was required by several counterparties. But I don't recall a specific time frame. I would think it was probably later into August, but I don't have a specific recollection of the time frame.
I'm sorry, Mike. Is that August 2007 or August 2008?
August 2008. Again, prior to my involvement, I'm not aware of what our staff knew with regard to collateral calls prior to July of 2008.
Okay.
And I'm sorry if I confused the dates of 07 and 08. I hope I've been accurate in each of the statements. Really, most of my effort and knowledge is really 2008 forward.
I realize, and I hope you understand, I've been kind of couching the questions, realizing that you took over leadership function in July of 08, but because of your position in the agency and because of your background in CIO, I just thought it was relevant to ask if you knew of anything prior. That's, but I understand. Thank you. Line of question, if you will. But when did you or the OTS first become aware of the securities lending unit, and specifically the investment of the cash collateral by the counterparties into private label RMBS that was backed by subprime mortgages and Alt-A mortgages?
You know, the securities lending issues, I did not become aware of until the final days of AIG's crisis. Again, normally we would receive information from the functional supervisors of those areas, and I believe the securities lending, as I understand it, was conducted across the insurance companies. I did not become aware of any information until the very late days in the crisis with regard to the concerns that existed across the insurance firms. With regard to when staff might have become aware of securities lending issues, again, I'm not aware of when anyone else might have become aware, but I'm aware of when I was informed that we had information. And again, that was in the final days of AIG's crisis.
So did you have any role in meetings between the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and AIG, or any internal meetings within Treasury during the weeks leading up to the Fed emergency loan? And if you did have meetings, who did you meet with, and what were the topics?
I did not have any meetings with the Treasury with regard to the transaction.
What about the Federal Reserve Bank of New York?
With the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, there was a request for a meeting with our examination staff in the July timeframe to discuss the counterparty risk that AIG had with a number of large firms. I believe that meeting ultimately took place in the month of August. For some reason, August 11th is coming to my mind, in which our exam staff met with staff at the New York Federal Reserve. The meeting was hosted here at MTS, Jersey City. And again, they discussed the various different counterparty risks that AIG had with other large firms. I was not at that meeting, but there was a meeting note that was produced that summarized the discussion at that meeting.
Would it be possible to get that, a record of that, if there were any notes, or just maybe flag it that you guys already, OTS already produced that in its base number, whatever?
I would guess it was produced, but we can certainly follow up.
I'm sorry, I've looked at quite a few documents yesterday and the day before, but I don't recall running into that one. I recall a meeting invite with OTS executives on the weekend before the Fed emergency loan, but I don't recall seeing anything about the August 11th, where OTS is providing intel, let's say, to the FRB New York on the counterparties.
I just have a binder of some of the information that was related to AIG. It was an August 11th meeting report that was prepared by EICO or on a meeting with the Federal Reserve, Kevin Coffey, an examining officer, and Elise Levers, an insurance specialist. And I know there are copies of that document in our record, so you may have it, but we'll email that separately. So I'm aware of that meeting with the Fed, again, to discuss various counterparty risks with regard to the credit default swaps. The discussions with the Federal Reserve during the period of the crisis, I was involved in weekend calls over what I would call the Lehman weekend, I think it was September 13th, 14th, with the New York Fed, as well as a host of other supervisors, including foreign supervisors, about the crisis and the impact that it was having on a number of different firms. Those discussions were not specifically on AIG at the time, so I would not say that I was in discussions with the New York Fed about AIG over that Lehman weekend. However, there were discussions I know that OTS officials were having with the Federal Reserve, and to a certain degree, I think there were several phone calls from Treasury to our leadership over that weekend. But again, I don't have the knowledge of what was specifically discussed other than what was conveyed to me by emails. So I think when those discussions were occurring with the New York Fed or with Treasury, my understanding is that they were occurring at higher levels, which would have been Director Rich, Senior Deputy Director Scott Polakoff, and perhaps Tim Ward or then Chief Counsel John Bowman. But again, those discussions were centralized in the Washington office.
You mentioned something a little earlier about securities lending, and I understand that as the consolidated supervisor, you don't want to have any overlap between yourself as enterprise supervisor versus the functional regulation of the various states. And as you correctly pointed out, the securities lending unit involved the pooling of the monies from the various insurance companies that were wrapped up to AIG. If you were to have noticed any risk in that particular area that was included in the public filings in the 10-Qs and the 10-K, how would you have approached that with the functional regulators, the insurance regulators, whether or not they were taking appropriate action to minimize risk upon the enterprise?
So the question I'm hearing is one that is hypothetical in nature. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yeah, both hypothetical and also, I guess, as a matter of fact, that this activity was going on. So we would like to learn more about the interaction between the OTS and the functional regulators, if there was any, and what kind of discussion was there regarding the securities lending unit and the risks of investing cash collateral in private label RMBS that, while highly rated, were backed by high-risk subprime mortgages. And we wanted to just try to learn a little bit more about that.
So OTS uses a number of processes to try to understand the risks that might exist in functionally regulated entities. One of the centerpieces of that knowledge gathering is the supervisory college that we would host, which is a concept of bringing together the most significant relevant supervisors for internationally active firms. So we would conduct a supervisory meeting once a year, at least, for, again, the significant supervisors. And during that time, we look to solicit their views on some of the most significant risks that might exist across the entities that they have responsibility for supervising, so we can get a better picture of the potential risk that their activities have on a consolidated basis. We also use that as an opportunity to share views that we have when we look at the organization across the whole organization. I know for AIG they did conduct supervisory colleges, and I'm aware that the lead insurance supervisors were invited and I believe did attend With AIG, I think that would have included New York, Pennsylvania, Texas, and maybe some other states as well. But I do recall those three states as being active participants in supervisory college meetings. And again, we would look to solicit information from their day-to-day work as to what issues they might be aware of that we should be aware of. From an OTS perspective as well, we would look to obtain copies of examinations from functional supervisors over their regulated entities so that we could keep apprised beyond that once a year meeting, but on an ongoing basis of new findings that were coming out. And while I don't know specifically how many exams we would have reviewed from the various different insurance supervisors, my understanding of the process would have been that we would have been obtaining those exams over time and making an assessment as to whether or not there were issues that should be encompassed into our overall supervisory work. So, I mean, in general, that is the approach that we would take with a functionally regulated entity. I think GLIBA does permit, to a certain extent, the functional holding company supervisor to go and examine already regulated subsidiaries, but they're quite significant exceptions that need to occur where there's either not a sharing of information or we believe that there's a risk that is greater than what's been identified by that functional supervisor. And I'm not aware of OTS making a decision to actually go in and examine insurance companies on our own.
Okay. Thank you. Now, part of this next question pertains to your testimony in May of, I guess, last month to the Congressional Oversight Panel regarding the OTS role and authority and the supervision of AIG. And really, I guess the fourth point that you made on that testimony, it really conflicts with the information that we have gathered from OTS, our discussions with other OTS officials, our review of the Holding Company Supervisor's Handbook, AIG Holding Company Inspection Reports, and importantly, the Federal Register in April and December of 2007 that delineates OTS's supervisory rating criteria over savings and loan holding companies. And I do notice that early on in 2000, 2001, in the examination reports, I could see clearly how you rate a holding company. You assign it above average, satisfactory, or unsatisfactory. And it's all targeted for what is the relationship of the enterprise and the insured thrift. Okay? Now, in this case, I mean, the IDI was always 0.1, 0.2% of total consolidated assets. So, really, the thrift, when you consolidated, it was really immaterial to AIG's scope of operations. So we were wondering if you could help us, you know, reconcile the differences that we see. We see something contrary to what you said to the Congressional Oversight Panel, that OTS is the consolidated supervisor and it looks at risk across the enterprise, and when it assigns thrift savings and loan holding company rating, it's looking at the condition of the savings and loan and not solely the relationship and the impact that it has on the thrift. So I'm sorry for asking a very long-winded, kind of rambling question. I apologize for that. And if you'd like me to repeat it, I can repeat it and rephrase it.
Well, let me attempt to give you the answer I think that would be responsive to your question. And if I didn't hear the question correctly, you can certainly, you know, clarify that. The point I think that, and I think it was a follow-up question that Chair Warren had with regard to what OTS would do in assessing the insurance companies. Under GLIBA, there is a framework that was put out that calls for respect for functional supervision. And there is parameters that are put into play where the regulators would need to rely on the information that a functional supervisor would provide to a holding company supervisor. And I believe that is consistent in a bank holding company structure sure. as well. And the ability for that consolidated supervisor to actually go in and examine a company that is regulated by a different functional supervisor, the conditions that would allow for that are limited. And again, I'm not aware of OTS ever making a determination that a specific state supervisor was not producing or accurately assessing the risk of an insurance company. I'm just not aware of that ever occurring. Our holding company authority and our holding company framework allows for us to assess the overall condition of a firm, including the impact that other regulated entities might have on the overall condition of the firm. And so we do gather information from functional supervisors, but from the consolidated holding company as well. And I mentioned Section 940 of the handbook. When we get intra-group transactions and we look at risk concentrations, it's not just within the entities that we have direct responsibility for, but also across entities where there are functional regulators. So we seek to obtain that information that would be helpful to make the overall assessment. So I hope you don't find my views conflicting, because I do think that there is a consistency there. We do look at the overall firm, and we do attempt to make an assessment of all of the entities' impact on the consolidated firm. The difference I'm saying is we will very infrequently make a decision to go examine a regulated entity. So that's the distinction I'd like to make.
You know what, Mr. Finn, thank you. That's precisely what my understanding is of your role. And it kind of dovetails with the Federal Reserve mantra of consolidated supervision and that supervisory doctrine. I understand that. And I'm sorry, I should have mentioned it. What you said was on page 3 of your testimony. And it basically, I'll read the first sentence or so. It says, and this is in response, you start off by saying, before I begin the discussion, I would like to clarify 4 points about AIG's collapse. And point 4 you make, the legal framework for OTS authority to regulate holding companies was not primarily designed to protect holding companies from problems, but to ensure that safety and soundness of the underlying thrift institutions, to assess the impact of the holding company's activities on the thrift, and to prevent holding company actions from harming the thrift and its depositors. So when I read that on page 3, it almost sounded to me like it reverted back to what I was seeing in the holding company inspection reports circa 2000-2001, where it was very much focused on how is the holding company condition going to impact the thrift? And what I would present is when you have a holding company that's so large and the thrift being 0.2% of total assets at its height, there's very, you can't really see a situation, or there's fewer situations where the holding company is really going to impact the thrift unless there's like inappropriate transactions, intercompany transactions going on between the two. So I think that's what I probably should have started off with saying, but thank you for your answer. What you said is my understanding of OTS authority, that it's very broad.
Again, to assess, to evaluate holding companies, we do have very broad authority. Our ability then to take action, enforcement action, though, does tie back very specifically to the impact that a holding company's activities would have on a thrift. So where our enforcement authority at the thrift level is quite broad and extensive in terms of the range of actions we can take. At the holding company, there is a different manner of which enforcement actions we can take, where in order to substantiate actions at a holding company, we do need to have a connection to the impact that those activities might have on the thrift. So, again, I think we supervise holding companies because they own thrifts. So, I mean, realistically, or, you know, the primary reason we're there, and I think that was the statement of the testimony, was not to protect the holding company necessarily. We're there because it owns an insurance repository institution. And in order to assess the impact that a firm has on the institution, we need to make an evaluation of the whole organization. I think our OTS supervisory position evolved over time as international supervision evolved, and I think we tried to keep pace with that in terms of some of the changes that we made for consolidated supervision. We wanted to adopt practices that were more reflective of what was considered to be the evolving or best practices across the international framework.
Now, you know, we're the consolidated supervisor of GE as well.
Right.
But we don't have the authority to tell GE to stop making a type of jet engine or types of washing machines.
No, I understand.
The authority really has to do, stems from the risk of the thrift that they own rather than the holding company itself.
Right.
I think that's what Mike kind of means, and by way of analogy, I just wanted to point that out to you.
Okay. No, I understand that you wouldn't delve into the individual financial products or business products only to the extent that those business lines create a risk that's so high that it impacts the condition, the financial condition of the top tier parent, and therefore provides a diminished source of strength to the insured institution. Would that be a correct statement?
I think that is correct. We would attempt to evaluate the overall condition of the firm as opposed to any specific activity that a firm is conducting. Again, if the activities are significant, we would look to assess how that activity impacted the overall condition. An example would be the work that we did at FP, at Financial Products. While that was not a regulated entity, and we didn't have any direct responsibility for supervising that entity, there was no regulatory framework that said OTS is the primary supervisor of a firm that conducts credit default swap activities, we did need to assess whether or not the range of activities there had an impact on the broader firm.
Right.
And again, the exam team attempted to do that through the work throughout the course of the last several years in terms of making an assessment, including visitations to FP, conducting examinations of reports and management processes. So there would be times where we would look at individual activities, but generally they would have to be fairly significant in the overall holding company complex.
No, I understand. I understand that the CDS is kind of like a non-regulated product, but I also understand that OTS has the authority to look at any affiliate and determine its impact on the holding company enterprise. And particularly with FP, we saw the multi-sector CDS book go from $2.2 billion in 2002 to about $78 billion in 2007. So that CDS book grew, that specific portion of the CDS book grew by over 35-fold. So I think that was probably the genesis of you going in, obviously, and looking and doing targeted reviews of FP and trying to get your hands around the risk profile that siloed had on the condition of the top-tier parent, to what extent that's going to negatively impact the condition of the top-tier parent. I mean, that's that much I've gathered from your records. And just correct me if I'm wrong.
I think it is correct that part of the process that we go about on an annual basis with a firm like AIG, and which I understand did occur at AIG, would be to make a risk assessment each year as we plan our supervisory activities. And to the extent that the size and scope of an individual subsidiary's activities were significant and relevant to the consolidated entity, we would look to consider supervisory work in those areas. And again, I'm aware that over the last several years, the exam team did conduct activities with FP, presumably because when they did their risk assessment, they did see that there was risk there and probably growth as well over time.
Right. I just want to follow this up because I find it a little bit troubling as the consolidated supervisor here that I think it's a matter of focus. Is what's the OTS's focus as the consolidated supervisor on the holding company or on the insured thrift? And particularly, I'm a little bit troubled by your written statement before the COP, when it says it's not designed to protect the holding company from problems. And that seems to me to be a little bit different than what the EU is expecting in the MOU with the EU entities. And I'm just wondering what the focus of OTS's supervision is here.
There are two different sets of rules for the different types of firms. So the insured depository institution is subject to a much broader framework of rules and regulations that cover their activities. And so the examination process around an insured depository institution is much more precise over each of those various regulatory areas and in assessing what are the CAMELS factors in terms of how we evaluate a depository. In a holding company supervision, the framework is not as explicit in terms of the areas that we must cover under regulation. The authority to supervise a holding company is quite broad, but it does all tie back to we're doing those activities to assess the relationship between that holding company and its subsidiary. Because there are transactions with affiliate rules and other rules that govern that relationship, whether or not you have control, change of control, those types of rules are there from a holding company perspective. And we do need to make an assessment of a holding company's strength and impact that it might have on a thrift, because, again, that may impact the decision we want to make in our supervision of the thrift. So I think the two responsibilities are quite different in terms of the approach that we take. And at the holding company, while we are looking very broadly across the whole company, we don't have a mandate, as we do with the thrift, to protect the deposit insurance fund in supervising the thrift. We don't have that same mandate at the holding company, say, to protect from bankruptcy. We do want to assess whether or not a firm is running into financial difficulty, because often that can have an impact on subsidiaries and related organizations. But again, there's not a specific mandate that causes us to regulate companies to prevent them from getting into problems. And we see issues that might have an impact on the broader on the broader subsidiary. I think we do elevate the responsiveness that we request of holding company management. But again, we do have to understand the relationship that it would have with the thrift as well.
I'm not sure that the EU would. That was what was intended by the EU, though, when they said, you know, OTS is the consolidated supervisor here. So that's one question. And I guess then the follow-up question is, who does have that mandate? Who is looking at the bankruptcy or the safety and soundness of the holding company if it's not OTS as the consolidated supervisor?
I guess to clarify, I'm not saying we don't look at it and we don't make that assessment. What I'm saying is the regulations, the Savings and Loan Holding Company regulations, they're not written in the same manner as they are with the bank in terms of preventing preventing a loss to the insurance fund. We do make an assessment, and when we see issues that create situations that would cause financial challenges or financial difficulties, again, those are weighed into our rating, and we would share that information with relevant foreign supervisors, as we did periodically with the supervision of AIG. So it's not to say we don't look to see if they have problems. It's not, but our specific mandate is not to prevent those problems. It is to evaluate and see whether or not they may occur, and to make sure that we are informing regulators that we have a shared responsibility with. So we do make an assessment of whether or not there are financial problems. I'm just trying to say that our rules, as I understand the savings and loan holding company rule, are not written to prevent failure. We certainly make an assessment, and when appropriate, when a situation occurs that may have an adverse impact on a thrift, we may need to elevate to an enforcement action to cure certain situations. But the rules are not, those savings and loan holding company rules are not written to prevent failure. I think we in our testimony to the Congressional Oversight Panel, we did offer views that OTS strongly supports the concept of a systemic risk supervisor and an orderly resolution process for systemically significant companies. I think it's clear that from an agency standpoint, that is a shared view that the OTS has, that there needs to be a better process of looking consistently across these systemic companies, and also having a process to go through a resolution of a systemically important company, because at this juncture, the option is bankruptcy or bailout. And OTS has no tools, liquidity or funding-wise, to prevent a failure of a company. So, again, a decision comes where, in the supervision of those firms, one option, the only option that was available to a firm like AIG was bankruptcy, unless there was a broader decision by other regulators to take a different action.
When you're talking about the rules governing the holding company, you're talking about sort of the, if I understand it correctly, about the OTS sort of framework and the handbook, I think you were referring to before. Is that right? It's the internal OTS processes with respect to the holding company. Is that correct?
When I refer to rules, I'm really referring to regulations. And it would be specifically the Savings and Loan Holding Company Act.
And what are the limitations with respect to enforcement actions against the holding company that are laid out in those rules, as you understand it?
And I think that's a good point. As I understand it, I think, you know, our legal counsel, in terms of determining when we can take an enforcement action, when we would have the authority, as I'm aware of it from counsel that I've been given, is that our enforcement powers are limited at the holding company level in terms of the range of actions that we could take based on the activities that are occurring and the impact that they might have on the thrift organization. So there needs to be a connection between the specific issues at hand, whether or not we would use enforcement powers. There has to be a nexus to those activities likely having an adverse impact on the thrift institution. Again, I'm not a lawyer myself, but as we've considered over my history here, actions against holding companies, that is always one of the factors that has been considered.
So there's nothing that your authority and powers would not preclude you from rating a complex enterprise a composite 4 or a composite 5 and enacting some type of an enforcement action because there's rapid dissipation of capital at the enterprise level, rapid erosion of earnings, and a greatly diminished source of strength that would provide protection for the insured bank. Not necessarily intercompany transfers that violate any rule, but simply there's nothing that would preclude you that this top-tier parent is rapidly deteriorating, there's dissipation of capital occurring, there's huge asset quality problems, and as at the end of the day, we have serious concerns about the source of strength that parent is going to have upon the bank. We're going to rate you a composite 4 or we're going to rate you a composite 5 because the definition of that means if there's not immediate attention, the solvency of the holding company that the savings and loan holding company you're regulating is in question. And really what we had in September, we have documents from the Fed saying that if we don't give them an injection or if something doesn't happen, they're going to run out of cash. They'll have no cash by Wednesday. 17th of September. So I just wanted to throw that out, that it doesn't seem like nothing in your powers would preclude you from rating a complex enterprise to composite 4 or composite 5 and putting some type of a formal action on them, correct?
We certainly have the ability to rate firms 4 or 5, and that does occur in the normal course. There would be an expectation that we would take some action. What I'm offering is that the form of action, when you talk about a formal enforcement action, if we were to do that in assessing whether or not we have the authority to take that specific action, we would consider and need to evaluate the impact on the threat. But we certainly do have the authority to rate holding companies 4 or 5, and we do have enforcement ability at the holding company level. In order to do that, we would have to assess the impact of those activities on a 4 or 5.
I guess I'm still a little bit hard. I'm having troubles understanding, and maybe it's because I'm not a banker, but if the rest of the entire company is going bad for whatever reason, and I use that sort of broadly, but the thrift is doing okay, how would you make that assessment other than this supervisory college that you meet once a year? It seems to me you won't have any input as to understanding how the rest of the enterprise would fare when the examination that OTS is really going through is really focused on the thrift, when everything else around it might be going bad or turning south.
I don't think that I've said that our examination is focused on the thrift. What I've tried to indicate is that there are two different examination processes. There's a specific examination of the thrift, which uses the council approach, and then there's our holding company process, which is a continuous process. So there is the supervisory college discussion to look across and gather information from those various supervisors. But then throughout the course of the year, as the continuous examination goes on, examiners are conducting specific work exercises at various different parts of the organization, as well as receiving any updates of examinations that are coming out of functionally regulated entities. So it's not to say that, I have not been trying to say that at the holding company, most of our effort is focused on looking at the thrift. It's certainly looking more broadly and gathering information to try to make the assessment at the on a consolidated basis.
Let me ask it, and we might be going over a little bit of territory we've already gone over. I apologize for that, but between the time frame of, say, July 08 and September 08, what activities did you have under your supervision, or what activities were you taking in AIG unrelated to the thrift, but looking at the overall enterprise holding company of AIG? What activities were you doing?
The examination team was conducting activities during that time frame of July and August and into September. My specific activities are from a managerial perspective and discussing with other managers the feedback that is coming up from the examination. So if I can, on the question, you talk about what activities, is that exam activities?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what kind of exam activities were going on during that time under your guidance?
So there would have been a supervisory plan in place that had processes that we were going through. Again, I had mentioned earlier that during that July-August time frame, I know the examiners were working to evaluate conditions at FP, including the London operation, and using the information that they had been gathering to draw up a work plan for the September visit. That was one of the activities that was being conducted. One of the other significant activities, and my guess would be, again, without actually being on site specifically, one of the significant activities that would have been occurring at that time would have been an assessment of the remediation plan. There were many, many elements and pieces that were required out of the March supervisory letter. And again, the information and response that was there, the examiner would have had to be reviewing that in order to make ultimately a determination that at least the plan for remediation was acceptable. Beyond that, there's normal communication flow across various different supervisors. And again, I would not have been involved in those directly during that time frame. But again, there would be periodic communications, both domestically and internationally, as new information is coming up. So the team would be involved in those types of discussions as well.
So if I'm understanding correctly, in that 3 or so month period where there's significant stress in the marketplace and the AIG, I mean, OTS is developing a work plan for the London FP, which starts, I think, September 2nd, a couple weeks before they fail, or, you know, they're bailed out. And there's an assessment on the remediation that OTS, I think, approved on August 28th, also just a couple weeks before, and normal communications. But over a 3 month period, when there's all this volatility and stress, that doesn't seem like a lot of real supervision. And I just wanted to challenge that a bit to just try to understand if that was the sum total of the activities that OTS was engaged in.
Again, I'm trying to give you as much of a perspective as I can from the seat that I was in with regard to the day-to-day activities that were going on in AIG.
Yeah.
I know there have been interviews with the staff that was working at AIG. I'm not sure if the EIC Tom O'Rourke was available for interviews because I think he's on military duty, but I'm giving you the range of activities that I was aware of that were being conducted. I did try to say that there would have been and there was a supervisory plan in place that would have included a broader range of activities. I'm responding with you the activities that I would be aware of that they were conducted. There certainly could have been more, and on a day-to-day basis, again, there might have been more discussion with regard to particular stresses and reports that were coming out of AIG. We certainly do have regular contact with the firm and would have been trying to evaluate the changing dynamics of the situation. But I'm not directly aware of those day-to-day contacts.
Okay, and that's all I was asking is from your perspective, and you're at a senior level here. I'm sorry.
Mr. Finn, let me ask you, while at July of 08 and before the government bailout, and even before, if you have knowledge, do you know if there was ever any formal action contemplated to take on AIG? Any formal action, such as a formal agreement, a cease and desist order on AIG, the parent? I know there was informal action taken by virtue of the downgrade, but any formal action, to your knowledge, if it was ever discussed, either within legal, general counsel, the highest level of the agency.
You're saying, was there any before the bailout?
Let me go more broadly. In 2008, was there ever any discussion of placing AIG under a formal enforcement action, whether a formal agreement or a cease and desist order, anything like that?
The region, as AIG was going through its financial difficulties, the region did recommend a ratings downgrade and a declaration of the parent company to be in a troubled condition, which is a notification of additional operating restrictions that would be put in place. However, that was in the September time frame, and going prior to that, I'm not aware of anything that occurred I'm not aware of anything that occurred prior to July where I wouldn't have had any direct involvement. And I'm not aware of any discussions during the July or August time frame. But obviously, as the situation was precipitating to truly be a liquidity crisis that could have caused the company to go into bankruptcy, we did make a recommendation for a downgrade and to a declaration of a troubled condition. The firm was going through negotiations with the Treasury and the Fed at that point in time, and a decision was made not to move forward with that, with those actions, to allow the Fed to have an opportunity to facilitate an orderly resolution. So, but prior to that, again, peak of crisis action, I'm not aware of any determination or I'm not aware of any consideration for formal action. I will note, going back probably 2 years earlier, the OTS did take an action against AIG FSB with regard to its lending practices. That was an action that did elevate to an AIG parent subsidiary, and I'm not recalling the name of it off the top of my head.
Wilmington Finance.
Wilmington Finance, thank you. So we did take a formal action. It was in the form of a supervisory agreement with regard to lending practices that were being conducted at the bank platform, but which were conducted also with an affiliate of the AIG parent. So again, that action was taken against a holding company and a subsidiary, but again, those activities were related to the lending practices that were seen at the FSB and the relationship that it had with the holding company affiliate.
Okay, thank you. And just to circle back, the designation for troubled condition and the downgrade, that occurred on 9/30/2008. That's the letter that we saw. And you're saying the reason why it wasn't done earlier in September is because, if I gather correctly, you didn't want to interrupt the process that AIG and the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York were going through at the time to try to come to a resolution, a liquidity resolution, some type of a lending facility. Is that fair?
If you could, I'm just trying to look back to a series of emails that occurred right around that time frame, because I can't recall the specific dates in which it occurred. You mentioned September 30th. My recollection was perhaps that it was a little bit earlier.
Well, September 30th is the letter that we have that has your name on it that's going to the AIG General Counsel, saying that we're downgrading you to a composite four. This is the parent company, and there's also language around there about, you know, you're in a troubled condition. But the reason why I brought up 9/30 is it wasn't done sooner, because you mentioned that during the second week there were these negotiations going on between AIG and Treasury and AIG and Federal Reserve Bank in New York, because they were trying to come to a resolution. You didn't want to get in the way of that, so that's why it happened later. Is that fair to summarize that way?
I believe that I've shared this information as part of the request for information by the FCIC. That I'm thinking of the Tuesday, September 16th email at 1:38 that I issued to Tim Moore, in which I said, "Tim, over the weekend, AIG management was working to resolve its collateral needs and reported to me late Sunday that it was not able to complete several contemplated transactions. We are fully aware of the fragile condition of AIG at this point, given the ratings downgrades. OTS would normally seek to downgrade the holding company rating as a firm condition deteriorates, and to seek appropriate corrective actions. Given the incredibly fluid situation yesterday and today, including the new rating agency downgrades that have further stressed liquidity, we have not pursued a downgrade of AIG's exam rating or taken enforcement action at this point to allow AIG management time to work through its immediate liquidity crisis. Scott Polakoff has advised me that the director was briefed by Treasury, Ryan, and New York Fed Geithner a short time ago about the current state of discussions with the AIG. We do not intend to take any immediate action relating to the holding company so that all parties involved can focus their energies on potential situations. or potential solutions, excuse me, and it continues on. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to see this. This is what I was saying.
Yes.
Normally, as you mentioned, as conditions significantly deteriorate, a reaction would be to make an interim assessment. And we were considering doing that because, obviously, the company was going through significant stress. At the point in which the Treasury and the Fed began to open negotiations with the firm to take action that would perhaps precipitate an even more challenging situation was seen to be counterproductive at that point.
Right.
And a decision was made to defer to take action. So I just want to make sure, if you don't have this, again, I apologize, I'd be happy to share.
No, don't apologize, Mr. Finn. I know you guys produced a lot of documents, and that's just probably one that I did not see. But no, it, what you're saying makes sense. That's why it was. That's why we see 9:30 as the date and not earlier in the September time frame. I mean, that makes it clear.
What we did is we continued to prepare documents in case we chose to move forward. But again, I advised our senior leadership that given the dynamics of the liquidity crisis and the ongoing work that was occurring with the Fed and Treasury, that in my view at that point to make a downgrade and take enforcement action may have exacerbated the situation.
Sure.
And made a recommendation that we would defer such an action.
Very good.
We did, however, choose to go forward with an action with a supervisory directive to the bank to ensure that the issues that were happening at the AIG parent would not have an adverse impact on the banking subsidiary in terms of protecting it from transactions with affiliates that might be abusive or problematic, and also to make sure that the bank was identifying any issues that might have an impact if AIG were to go in and succumb to the crisis, how the bank would ensure that its systems and operations could be protected. So we did actually issue a supervisory directive. I think it was on that same date, September 16th,
right,
where we chose not to go forward on the holding company. We did put what we would call a ring fence around the bank to ensure that it was not in any way harmed while the parent was going through crisis.
Do you think we could get a base number on that document you were reading from? That we could just try to put in our system to so it'll pop up?
It's 9/16, right, Mike? September 16th?
It is a September 16th email from me to Tim Ward, copying Scott Polakoff and Regional Deputy Director Michael Simone. It also attaches the supervisory directive that we issued.
We should be able to find that for it.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I know you did provide it. It hadn't popped up in our review yet.
I took my whole email inbox with AIG Matters and produced it, and this is one of the emails that was within that inbox.
That's right. So you have both.
That's fine. Thank you. Yeah.
Both collective files and the emails for two or three of the people he's mentioned on that email, so we shouldn't have too much trouble finding it.
Jay, you have anything? There is an internal document. It's called CIO Program, and the body of the document says follow up questions for OTS. I don't know what it's pertaining to. I don't know if it's a GAO line of question. It's just appeared in the production that we got access to this week. It has your name on it. It just says, and I'll quote to you from the document, it just says, OTS seems to have devoted relatively few resources to AIG's oversight compared with Washington Mutual. Could you comment on the difference? And it just has in parentheses, Mike Finn. And I'm sorry, I couldn't give you anything more, but it's base stamped, and it's just the subject body. It's called follow-up questions for OTS, and it looks like an internal document called CIO Program. And what I read to you, that's exactly what the document says. Do you want to share with us? I guess the question is could you comment on the difference?
I am not familiar with. I don't recall the document, so I'm not sure even in which time frame it would be discussing.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The document that I'm looking at, I can't tell either. I do know that it was after 2007 because it discusses things that happened here in 2007. But I'm sorry. I'll show it to Chris. Maybe.
That's the question. Just comparing IG with WAML.
Sorry, Mike. I think they're trying to triangulate what type of question would have precipitated that document.
There's so many potential sources for a set of questions.
Yeah, it could have been one of the congressional hearings GAO audit.
It looks to me like it's probably an IG inquiry in the aftermath of AIG to say, we got inquiries giving us a list of questions,
right.
And those look like individuals who should address the answers.
Sure.
One of the questions, Mike, on there that he's referencing is just basically to compare the way that we approached supervision of AIG with WAMU. I think that's really the question that you're asking right now.
Yeah, no, I'm just reading right off of the sheet.
And that's what
I couldn't see.
I've not seen it before. My name's not on there, so if it was, I might have remembered it. But it looks to me like.
Do you want to get back to us on that, Mike? I mean, if you do, that's fine.
If you could just clarify the specific question that you would like to answer, because I'm not sure I understand what you've asked.
No problem. I'm just reading from the sheet. It says, and I'll quote to you: OTS seems to have devoted relatively few resources to AIG's oversight compared with Washington Mutual. Could you comment on the difference? That's just exactly verbatim what I'm reading off of. And then it had your name in brackets, Mike Finn. And it presumably that was a question that may have been directed towards you by somebody. It's just an OTS document. And if you would like, what I can do is I could email you the question, or I could email it to Chris, and then you could reflect on it and respond, since you don't have the benefit of looking at this right now.
Well, I mean, if you substantively you want an answer, I think Mike can explain to you a little bit how we would approach WAMU differently than the way that we approached AIG. If you don't remember the background of this, I don't think it makes any difference whether we send it to you or not. I mean, if you wanted to address the differences between how we would approach WAMU and AIG.
Yeah, I mean, if you could address the question about the resources, I think that was the nature of the question. If you could comment on that, and if you don't know, you don't know. That's fine.
You know what? I don't specifically know what the comparative time would have been. It's not a question that I raised. It was a question that was asked. I do think in general there would be a difference in the amount of time that was conducted on examinations. In doing a CAMELS review, as I mentioned earlier, the regulatory framework for regulating the insured depository is much more precise and specific across numerous different disciplines: safety and soundness, compliance, trust, IT, a whole range of different areas that would be evaluated, and individual ratings that would be assigned in those CAMELS areas, particularly in terms of like doing an asset quality review where examiners would actually be looking loan by loan in order to assess the condition of asset quality. So the hours are, I would say, much more extensive in general looking at a banking organization than in general a holding company. AIG certainly would have required a more significant pool of resources, but probably not one that would have approached the pool of resources that would have been placed onto WAMU, which really, for the most part, as I understand the operation, was largely a banking operation. They may have had some holding company structure and activities, but it would have not been anything that was a diversified, internationally active scope like an AIG. So it would have been more resources likely on a WAMU bank exam than there would have, in general, on a holding company exam. Although AIG, being a unique holding company, internationally active, the pool of resources would have been broader than for other holding company exams.
I guess the other question is specifically tied to this document as well, and I just wanted to see again. This predates your formal role as lead supervisor for AIG, if you will. But I mean, I'll read it out, and you could comment one way or the other. And I'll quote from the document. It says, "In 2007 supervisory plan for AIG, OTS lists a caveat on the findings in the introduction. It says, it should be recognized that there is no absolute assurance that OTS's evaluation of a firm will uncover all serious problems or deficiencies which may exist." You know, fair enough. And then in another paragraph, it says, "internal purposes only." And then I'll quote from the document. It says, "at the time the 2007 supervisory plan was being drafted by the AIG on-site exam team, and the 2007 work plan was being considered, the EIC over the prior 2 year had been permanently assigned elsewhere in the Northeast region during the fall of 2006 roll-up examination, and the assistant EIC, presumably Mr. O'Rourke, was overseas on reserve duty." And I'll continue. It says, "no replacements or additional resources were being provided for additional leadership or examination work at that time. The acting EIC and one other examiner was all that remained for that time period. These two individuals felt that as difficult as it is to supervise a $1 trillion company with the limited resources previously provided, it would be even more difficult in 2007. So, and this is a long quote, and I guess if you want us to formally just send you the document and you want to respond later, that's fine. But do you have any reaction to what I just read?
I was not aware of the change or the active duty of the individual that you mentioned. I don't know how they handled it or why they chose to handle it in such a way. I was not actively involved at that point.
Who could we ask for a response? I guess, would we go back to ask Mr. Lee, since he was managing director of CIO during 2007? Would, or Brad Waring, who could we go back and circle back to see, you know, what kind of a response to this question or this issue would be?
The supervisory plan for that period would have been developed by the lead EIC and would go through a vetting process, I think up through likely Alex Luck, then Bradwire, and ultimately to CK League. So I think there may be numerous people that could offer some clarification as to that specific time frame.
Fair enough. I'll talk to Chrissy for about it.
I gave you. You should have in your email box now a time frame on the. On the corrective action plan. Kevin Anderson, who you talked to on Tuesday, sent to me. But if you have a specific question, just send it over to me, and I'll ask them to address it today.
Okay.
And see what we can get you an answer.
Okay. Mr. Finn, thanks for taking the time. There's just one last question, I guess, that people at the FCIC are usually concluding with. In your opinion, what went wrong at AIG, and what... You know, what could we learn from what happened? It's a very broad question, and you could go high level if you want.
Well, just give me a moment just to gather my thoughts on. So AIG was a very diversified company. Obviously, you're aware of the background. Operates in over 100 countries. Involved in multiple areas of financial services. And my understanding is that for years, and perhaps even decades, under the former CEO, Hank Greenberg, the management of those activities was extremely decentralized. What I've heard from our teams is that as they came in to do their work, as we built out the CIO process in 04, what they were observing was a firm that really did not have an enterprise risk management function, did not have the ability to gather and report up information and look at assessments across a firm and to ensure that risk management was in place on a comprehensive basis across the firm. So I think what went wrong initially was a lack of an appropriate risk management function that would have acted as a discipline or a counterbalance to some of the risk-taking activities that were occurring at, say, financial products and or the securities lending activities that were occurring across the firm. So I think that was one of the fundamental weaknesses that allowed the risk to build throughout the organization. I would also say that the dynamics of the market changed so dramatically in such a short time frame that AIG and many other large firms, including some of the America's most substantial firms and internationally active firms as well, did not appreciate the magnitude of risk that was building up in securitized assets, particularly in the subprime space, but also in the alt-A space. And the ratings that were being attributed to many of those activities and those assets, I think presented an appearance that the strength and quality of those assets was greater than what we're seeing today was probably true. Yet that those AAA ratings, the credit ratings, would often be a very important factor in how the market acts. It affects market pricing. It affects how you deal with counterparties as to whether or not collateral is required for certain transactions. So there was a significant reliance on the strength of credit ratings that were coming out of the rating agencies. They existed on the underlying bonds, but they also existed in the covenants that AIG executed with counterparties. And what ultimately happened to AIG is sort of a correlation of events. The bonds that it was providing insurance for, which had covenants that required collateral, were being downgraded very, very rapidly over a short time frame. In addition, there were other collateral provisions that required additional collateral if AIG's credit rating came down. And both activities, both actions were occurring at the same time. Where in the years before, when they were engaged in entering into these contracts, the firm was deemed to be a AAA rated company, and the bonds that they were securing were super senior AAA rated bonds. So I think that, again, there was a breakdown in the assessment of risk across the securitized assets, and a failure to appreciate the collateral requirements that it could occur if there was an extreme downgrade event. Not just a single notch or two notches, but an extreme downgrade event. And that is ultimately what drove the liquidity crisis, because those triggers were occurring in close proximity to time and in a very short duration of time. So I think that there were two factors. There were internal weaknesses in the risk management of the firm that were present for many, many years earlier. And only in the latter years of OTS's supervision did management actually begin to implement some of those actions. However, some of the activities were already on the balance sheet. And then, again, during the peak of the crisis, the combination of AIG's demise as an individual company and its ratings, as well as the credit ratings that were being downgraded significantly on the bonds that it was providing insurance against, those two factors, I think, overwhelmed the organization. From a liquidity perspective, capital itself was still positive and substantial at that point, but they did not have the capacity to provide the collateral that was required. So I guess those are two factors that I think were significant. Beyond that, as I testified in front of the Congressional Oversight Panel, I think in terms of how the regulators work together and the oversight over systemically important companies needs to be enhanced as well. There was not an option of an orderly resolution of AIG at that particular time. So really the two options, at least as I, when I listened to the Federal Reserve at the Congressional Oversight Panel, were bankruptcy or rescue. And again, I think the country is looking towards moving towards a framework that would allow for some alternative resolution. So, again, not having a third option at that point in time, that's what led to the ultimate bailout. And again, I can't speak for the Fed. I think that was a systemic risk decision that the impact of AIG would have on the system. But AIG did not have the capacity to handle the collateral calls at that point in time, which I think had elevated from what they were anticipating going into the Lehman weekend of being roughly $20 billion, with the additional multiple downgrades that were likely to occur that following week, that was elevated up to what I understand to be closer to $80 billion. And almost no firm, regardless of its size or its strength, could move collateral and liquid collateral that fast.
In March 2009 testimony, Scott Polakoff stated that OTS supervision fell short. Is there anything that, would you agree with that statement? And if so, is there anything that the OTS may have done differently, or another, ex-regulator could have done differently?
The weaknesses in the ratings on bonds and the impact that could have on firms that were actively involved in either investing in mortgage bonds or providing insurance for mortgage bonds was not as clearly seen in the early years before the subprime crisis emerged. And I think that regulators in general and OTS perhaps could have been more firm in restricting concentrations that would rely heavily on credit ratings. Our regulations allow institutions to invest up to 100% of assets in AAA credit rated instruments. And in hindsight, that could be an unsafe and unsound concentration. So I think again, OTS and regulators in general could have considered more firm actions against risks that relied heavily on external credit ratings. And I think during the Basel process, this was a movement, all supervisors were moving to accept credit ratings as being an appropriate capital management tool and risk management tool. And I think all of the regulators have pulled back from that. The other element that I would say we have a better appreciation for now, and I think other supervisors as well, is understanding what is needed in terms of liquidity stress testing. A liquidity stress test exercise for a triple A rated firm or a double A rated firm probably was not as rigorous as it needed to be. And when liquidity stresses are evaluated and contingency plans are designed, typically there's a range of stresses that's evaluated, but those stress scenarios often did not include the incredibly extreme event and what impact that might have. So in a liquidity stress testing plan, they might look at ratings, downgrades on other bonds or firms of 1, 2, 3, perhaps 4 notches. But if you're starting at AAA, you may still be investment grade even if you move 4 notches. The question is, what if you move 7 notches, 8 notches? And again, many of the liquidity stress testing models, I don't think fully evaluated, nor did AIG's fully evaluated the impact of the extreme downgrades going beyond, much beyond 3 or 4 credit rating downgrades. And again, I don't think there was an appreciation fully in their risk management process and our understanding of the liquidity events that might occur of the correlation between the firm's downgrade as well as the bond downgrades. So the two areas I see, again, from an OTS perspective, that we would do differently in a future space, and we have tried to address those issues, is the potential concentrations that could exist when there's a reliance on another party's assessment of risk, and then also in liquidity stress testing and what the expectations are there.
Thank you very much, Mr. Finn. I appreciate you making yourself available to us and addressing these questions and sharing your views with us. I don't have any more.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I do see the one item that I owe you then would be that August 11th meeting notes from Tom O'Rourke. I will work with Chris and Mark to make sure that is given to you. I do believe it was part of documents I produced, but we'll make sure that you get that as well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thank you.
All right.
Joe.
Okay.
Is it still on?
Okay. June. Can you just say June 18th? What is it, June 18th?
June 18th at 12 p.m.